So, the Buddha, the Bhagwan, after becoming enlightened, showing the deed of enlightenment and giving teachings, we usually refer to the three turnings of the wheel of Dharma, of which the Prajaparamita teachings are the supreme, and then the Heart Sutra, which is also known as the 25 verses of Prajaparamita Sutra, Prajaparamita teaching on 25 verses. So the Buddha remaining in this concentration of categories of phenomena called profound perception, and at that time Bodhisattva Avalokiteshvara was also meditating, absorbed in the emptiness of all the five aggregates as well. And so what this shows is that we should see that the five aggregates are empty of inherent existence. Or and so, in the in certain teachings, the Buddha taught how we go into samsara, how we are propelled into samsara, but didn't talk about the person who is propelled into samsara. But the Buddha taught selflessness, anatma theory, even in the first sermon of the his first sermon. So by saying in the Heart Sutra, the five aggregates also should be seen as being empty of inherent nature. What the Buddha was teaching was that not only the person who is designated on the basis of the five aggregates is empty of inherent nature, but even the basis of designation of the person, the five aggregates, are empty of inherent nature. So this phrase shows that not only the selflessness of persons, but also selflessness of phenomena. And so that the word here also in this phrase or sentence is in Tibetan, and in Sanskrit, in Chinese, and Vietnam, Japanese, in the Heart Sutra, this word also is not there. And so this is significant word. So to realize fully the selflessness of phenomena, you have to realize the emptiness or selflessness of phenomena, the five aggregates. So without realizing the selflessness of persons fully, you cannot get rid of this grasping itself of phenomena completely. So all the teachings of the perfection of wisdom teach that there is no essence in anything. So, of course, when teaching emptiness, there's always the subject on which the emptiness is established, such as the person, and then the parts, such as the mindfulness and so forth, and then also at the resultant state of Buddhahood, Buddha's powers and so forth are mentioned.
And so, after having enumerated all these different things, from beginning with the form or matter and so forth, up to the highest enlightenment of Buddhahood itself, the Buddha gives all the different objects. And then established emptiness on it. And so, in the Vajraparamita Sutras, it's said that these also are merely nominal and designated. So why this is so important to understand is, it is said in a sutra that, so because of ignorance about how this essenceless nature of things, we are bound in samsara, propelled in samsara, and therefore that the same sutra goes on to say that the compassionate one, through various means, led the sentient beings to this understanding. And so we suffer because of our ignorance about the law of causality, which in turn is rooted in ignorance of the true nature of things. And therefore, in order to uproot this, we need to understand emptiness. So Master Tsongkhapa makes this prayer that may he be able to make this teaching of dependent origination, which the Buddha has Buddha taught, after having gone through much hardship to find this understanding realization and to make it clear to sentient beings. And so the Buddha and then Master Tsongkhapa, who was the pioneer master of the Gelug tradition, and the great masters of India, like Nagarjuna and so forth, have in one voice said that emptiness, understanding emptiness, is very, very essential for us to overcome our suffering. And therefore, the texts written by these masters are very important to study. For example, we have the Mula Madhyamaka Karika, the Madhyamaka Avatara, and the 400 verses by Nagarjuna, Chandrakirti, and Aryadeva, respectively. And therefore, as it is important for us to study the text, it's not just sufficient to have these texts in our altar, but what we need to do is to study them. And when you study Madhyamaka treatises and Madhyamaka view, in the text, the masters use what is known as the reasoning as well as the logic of reductio ad absurdum. And therefore, in order to study this text, we need also, it's very important to study this text on logic and epistemology, because there is the saying of the yoke necks of the pramana or epistemology and Madhyamaka systems, combining them together. And so, in the past, of course, historically, with regard to the study of logic and epistemology, it used to be very prevalent in the Sakya tradition as well as Gelug tradition in the past, but today, the fact is that it is most prevalent amongst the Gelug tradition. And so, we have the three seeds of learning of the Gelug tradition, and where the study of Pramana and Madhyamaka is done in unison. And therefore, we need still to put effort in continuing this kind of rigorous study of our classic texts. And so, as Je Tsongkhapa says, So thinking what would be, what it means would be helpful for him, for me to disseminate this teaching on the dependent origination, just as we already found in the sutra, where it says that the Buddha, by using hundreds of different means, led sentient beings to the understanding of emptiness. So, we need to use all kinds of means to actually establish the foundation of Buddhism. So we're talking about the perfection of wisdom, and which is taught in the Abhisamaya Alankara, where right in the beginning, in the salutation verse, which is homage to the path of the hearers and so forth, which shows that it's important to understand emptiness in order to establish the path aspect and omniscience. And so, in our tradition, we have the three systems of lineages of Kadampa. So, the tradition that we have in these monastic institutions that I mentioned earlier, Sera Depung and Gadam monasteries, is the lineage called the Gadam Shungpawa, or the scholastic lineage. And so, in this system, we have the tradition of actually bringing all these classic texts that we study into the stages of the path to enlightenment, and which is put in, which is found in the Lamrim. And therefore, right in the beginning of the Abhisamaya Alamkara, we study about how to develop enthusiasm and to actually aspire to the path to enlightenment. And having developed this admiration and then also the aspiration to tread the path, we study these in Abhisamaya Alamkara and so forth. And then we also study what are the pitfalls of the path to enlightenment. And then there is also the study of the bringing all the these different practices into what are known as the 20 applications. And so at one time I heard about this from Genpema Gelsen, where he made a very inspiring, a marvelous kind of explanation, but I have forgotten the details, although I can still remember that he really made gave a great explanation at that time. And so the Gadam Shungpawa lineage did, we need to actually bring the teachings that are found in the classic text into the path to stages of path enlightenment. So when some master went to the Amdo region after studying in this all the texts, and he was renowned as someone who is a scholar in the Prajaparamita studies, and people asked him, is that true? Then he said, yes, this is Kunkin Jamyang Shepa. And so the Madhyamaka is the view of the Prajaparamita studies, and then the Abhidharma is the enumerations of different practices and different points, and then the Vinaya is the precept of the Prajaparamita, and then the logic and epistemological text is the law, the text to for reasoning of the Prajaparamita studies. So he said that in the study of the Prajaparamita, and all the other subjects come within it. And so we need to actually make this point clear to people, just as you would in the case of your own practice. So of course we can start our practice of Lamrim, our sacred path to enlightenment, beginning with devotion to Guru, reliance on Guru. But on the other hand, we can also say that of course we should reach the state of enlightenment, omniscient state of Buddhahood, and not just saying this, resorting to the words of the Buddha, but we should also make clear what are the obstacles to that omniscient, and the fact that we have the potential to see everything, potential to reach enlightenment or omniscience within us, and therefore lead sentient beings through this understanding of emptiness, and with that make them understand that it is possible for them to attain omniscient state, where you see everything simultaneously, all the diversities of things as well as the ultimate nature simultaneously. And therefore, through this kind of conviction, then you will have admiration and then aspiration to attain enlightenment, and then aspiration to cultivate a bodhicitta, and also compassion, and for that, and how aspire to cultivate this determination to be free from samsara. And for this, of course, we need to rely on, we need to go through listening to study the text, reflecting on the meaning and the meditation. And in order to be able to do these, go through these processes, then we need to rely on a qualified master. And so in the Kadam Lamrimpa tradition, we need to put all these practices into the stages of the path. And so the scholastic tradition, when it comes to teaching, we need to put the practices in order in accordance with the Lamrim, the stages of the graduated path to enlightenment. And then to put it concisely, we have the Kadam Mengak lineage, the fifth instruction lineage. So, with regard to the Kadam Mengak lineage, of course, it's something to do with very specific disciples to whom pith instructions would be effective. But today, what we need is where in the world we have all kinds of distractions around us. We need to follow the general procedure of teaching the Dharma. To present the Dharma in a very general structure of Dharma. And so I know one Ladakh Lama from Ladakh, and I asked this person if he or she takes his or her monastics to go to Bodh Gaya and to other places. And this person told me that if these monastics were taken into the plains, then it actually gives them opportunity to get distracted. And so this is similar to the narrow-mindedness of the communist Chinese leaders. So, of course, once someone is really equipped with all the understanding of the Dharma, then even though all these distractions and the glamorous things are seen by these people, they would be able to find that this will not actually cause them to become distracted to the marvels of samsara, but it will, on the other hand, strengthen their faith and devotion to the practice of Dharma by knowing the nature of samsara being samsara. So this is what we need, as Jabjitsha Rinpoche has told me, that when he saw all the different distractions in the world, then he was able to actually perceive them as being in the nature of suffering. So when it comes to practicing Buddha Dharma, we need to have a very broad-mindedness and not a very short-sighted, narrow-mindedness. So this is how the teachers should teach, give a very broad explanation, and then the practitioners themselves also must develop this broad understanding. So I'm not being disrespectful to other traditions. So all these traditions, religious traditions, are useful and helpful to many people. But some of my friends, Christian professor, have told me that these days in Europe, their traditional religious tradition, which believe in a creator God, it has become very difficult for them to actually explain to their followers. But people are taking much interest in Buddhism. So he was not telling me, I mean, he was very sincere when he was telling me this. It was not out of any kind of ulterior motive or anything. And so in Buddhism, we need to use 100% our mental ability by examining even the words of the Buddha and the words of your teachers. So I wish to tell a story here. About 40 years ago, when I first developed interest to have some discussions with scientists, of course, even in my childhood, and since my childhood, I have had this interest in science. And so, at that time, when I expressed this wish to an American lady who's following Tibetan Buddhism, I told her. So when I told her I'm interested in having discussions with scientists, she said, "Be careful, science is killer of religion." So this is what she said to me. Then I thought, and I remember that the Buddha had said, monks and scholars, just as a gold is tested by a goldsmith for its purity, likewise you should examine and investigate my teaching, but not follow it, and then follow it, but not out of your devotion. So he asked us to experiment and research and to examine his teaching, and then when it's really verifiable through reasoning and experience, then the followers should accept, otherwise not. And so just as certain texts are said to be provisional, so if the Buddha's own words are to be put under the lens of scrutiny for whether it can be the something can be that it can be taken literally or not, As the Buddha has said, just like gold is tested, the Nagarjuna and so forth have actually examined the teaching of the Buddha. And then many scientists whom I know, many of them are really broad-minded and unbiased, so they do not just make decision very quickly, but checks over and over again. And then when they really find something to be in accord with reason and logic, they accept it. Otherwise, through their experiment and research, when they find something not yet decisive, I mean, they would not draw any conclusion. And so, when the lady said that, I thought that the Nalanda masters actually checked and examined the teaching of the Buddha, and therefore there's no danger from science. And I thought to have discussions with scientists. And so, in the past, some Chinese documents said that Tibetans are very have very strong blind faith. And they said that they don't need to do any put any extra effort to get rid of this blind faith in religion. But as science progresses and develops further, this will automatically go away. And so now, after 30, 40 years, what's the situation now is that even amongst the scientists, there are people who are taking interest in Buddhism, and many actually are attracted to Buddhism. And so Buddhism, because it has to be verified through reason and experiment, research, and so forth. So, of course, I do not put any effort to proselytize people to Buddhism. And one time I met some German, some friends who told me that some German sponsors were ready to sponsor to build a huge Buddhist temple in France. And so then I told these people that you really need to think twice, because France is not a Buddhist country. As such, if you build a huge center, Buddhist center, and I told them, I wonder if it would be really appropriate to do so. So, for example, if some Christian came into Tibetan community, and built a huge Christian church, what would we think? What would we feel? Of course, it's a different matter if they build some schools. So in Arunachal Pradesh, in the Mon regions, when other religions actually are spread there, the people feel rather uncomfortable. And therefore, in a non-Buddhist country, if you build a huge Buddhist center, I mean, it would be quite inappropriate. So I actually asked them to desist from building this center. Perhaps I was had committed sin by saying this, because then I told them that it would be better, it would be good to set up such a center in Thailand or in Bangalore, in India. So we don't need to actually try to propagate Buddhism. As even in the Vinaya, we find the mention that until someone comes to and requests you teaching, you should not go forward. giving teachings. So since there is increasing number of people taking interest in Buddhism, so they are not taking interest because of the Buddhism saying that the guru devotion is important, and which comes in the Kadam Mangak lineage. And then there are people who are really desperate in their life and then come to the Buddhist centers. We have a problem with their difficulty with their livelihood. But the situation has changed today. There are people who take interest in Buddhism with knowledge of Buddhism and then becoming attracted to Buddhism with admiration and enthusiasm. And so, as I said, out of these three lineages of Kadamba, the Kadam tradition, so we need to today we need to make contribution to Buddhism following the Gautam scholastic lineage, and therefore study of the classic texts is very important. And then whereas in the case of the Kadam Lamrimpa and Kadam Mangapa, you need to focus on the teachings of the stages of heart enlightenment and also the pit instructions. And if you follow the Kadam Shungpa, the scholastic lineage, it's really important. It's very important to study these great texts. And so, as Jerome Buche says, that having done much learning and study, when you actually are deprived or when you actually lack the practice of Dharma, that is actually a sign of not having the instructions down to you as practice. So where did we stop yesterday? So we are on the fifth Dalai Lama's text.
So,
when you meditate on this reasoning, which has the four essential points, having studied them, so we need to identify this independent objectively existing objective I that appears to the mind, which is the object of negation, and when we establish emptiness. So emptiness is a mere negation, which is the negation of the self, independent self. So when you meditate on emptiness, the conception which grasped at some independent existence is severed. And so whether this is happening or not should be examined. So although you may try to focus your mind on this selflessness, there's still going to be frequently or constantly going to be this grasping at a self. Because of our habituation with it over a long period of time, since time beginningless. So you should still put effort, and even though this constant grasping at self or the self, you should still try to divert your mind towards the selflessness, and then you should develop this concentration towards the concentration on the selflessness, and in this way develop this an understanding and an experience which is the combination of the vipassana and shamatha. So place your mind in that kind of understanding. So in certain tantric practices, there is also meditation on non-conceptuality. Without meditating on focusing on emptiness for a while. So even in the Dzogchen practice, this is how it's led. And so you should be able to make distinction between whether the emptiness is a mere negation or what is known as an implicating negation and so forth. There's a lot of talks about this in different traditions, but you should be able to know the point of these statements. So when you are a certain emptiness, which is this mere negation of a self, independent self, then you should place your mind on it, and that is called the space-like meditation on emptiness and in absorption. So having developed concentration, single-pointed concentration, then when you use that to realize emptiness through investigation and analysis, and when you are able to do that, I mean, come to the conclusion and or insight into emptiness, then you are able to bring these two together, the shamatha and vipassana, focused on emptiness. And this is what we are dealing with here. So having developed certain degree of insight, special insight into emptiness, you still push yourself further, and then you will be able to experience very special pliancy of mind, and then that will lead to the actual, the real vipassana, focusing on emptiness. And then it says Sakya and Dakpokagyu traditions, great scholars of, and foolish people of these traditions, say that if there is conception, there is no view. So, of course, when it comes to talking about realizing emptiness with a very subtle mind, then if that mind is actually tainted with some kind of a grasping, then you cannot actually that view. You cannot have the view of emptiness. And therefore, Jerembuche also mentions that when you do tantric practice, you do focusing meditation and not doing any kind of analytical meditation, because by doing analysis, it would actually cause distraction and to your mind. And therefore, as the mind becomes subtler and subtler through these kind of practice in tantra, then you... The clarity of the mind also increases. And so perhaps this line can be explained in such context. So when you actually realize emptiness and emptiness becomes the object of your mind, then your mind is totally absorbed in emptiness, and you are not actually thinking that this is emptiness, as if the emptiness is somewhere out there, and your mind is realizing it, and there shouldn't be this duality in your perception. And so when you realize emptiness, the experience that you have is the mere negation of the object of negation. And so some of these scholars and foolish people say that in Gelug tradition, while the practitioner remains in this calm abiding, water of calm abiding, there is this vipassana, which is like a fish moving in the small fish moving in the water and called a popping out of the water. And so this is unfeasible, some say that. And then some who follow our own tradition also claim to have the insight into emptiness. And also some of our own practitioners, followers say that these other scholars of other traditions are actually talking from the ultimate point of view, and they actually proclaim it with... So in the past, we have Nyingmapas criticizing the Gelug, and Gelug scholars criticizing Nyingma tradition without actually understanding the full import of each other's traditions and the other traditions. So this is what's mentioned here by the fifth Dalai Lama. So the fifth Dalai Lama here is scolding these scholars. So having developed this experience of the space-like absorption, once you develop the conviction that there is nothing that exists independently, objectively, And when you see the varieties of things, they may appear to have independent existence, but from your own conviction, you will be able to say that, oh, this is not the way things are. So having done the space-like absorption, practice meditation, then what remains is that the very subtle interdependent nature of things, which is mere designated nature of things. And so, although things do not have, you'll be able to confirm that although things do not have any independent objective existence, but still, within this parameter of the designation, all the things can be the actions and their results and so forth, and good and bad and so forth can be posited. And so, what should appear to your minds during the post-meditation session is that things are merely in name, merely nominal, and therefore the illusion-like thing should be able to bring up in your mind. So what you'll be able to confirm is that things do not exist the way they appear to you. So having refuted this independent existence, the object of negation, then what remains is a mere name. And the seventh Dalai Lama says that do not think that the things have any independent existence, although the varieties of diversities of things appear to the six senses, but they do not have any. An independent existence. So when you relate this experience to yourself, this mere name, the I, which is a mere name, should appear to you as if it's like an illusion. So although the object of negation between what Dharmakirti, whose certain lines from Brahmanavartika are cited here in this text, may be different from the Madhyamaka tradition, but the general idea of the rejecting the object of negation when you want to establish emptiness is same. So Dharmakirti says that without rejecting or refuting the what is grasped at by this true existence, the mind clinging to true existence, or self, an independent self, there is no way this clinging can be overcome. Sometimes when you use reasoning, used to tell me that the reductio ad absurdum kind of logic is more powerful in combating this kind of grasping at true existence rather than the formal logic. And so as it is said, as Nagarjuna says that in using this kind of logic of reductio ad absurdum, if he says to his opponents that if things were to have any kind of objective existence, then they would not be dependent on causes and conditions. And therefore, as the As Master Tsongkhapa says, whatever is dependent on causes and conditions is said to be empty of inherent existence or nature. So things must be understood to be like illusion. So when you watch a magical illusion created by a magician, a magical in that magical creation, there is a person killing a magic called an elephant and lions and so forth that is created by also by the magician. So in Master Tsongkhapa's commentary on Mulema Dhyambaka Karika, he says that you should actually direct your mind towards that. That is actually some kind of a desperate kind of expression. So what we need to do here is that see that things do not exist the way they appear to us. So in the beginning, it's very difficult for us to actually bring to the conviction that things are merely nominal. And so this is difficult to understand and come to conclusion for us, but we should actually use the understanding of dependency. And when you, through this understanding of how things are dependently arisen, then you should actually draw your mind towards that conclusion that things are mere name. So the unique characteristic here is that things should be seen as merely like illusion such as the magical illusions of the horse and elephant and so forth, although they do not have any solid independent existence. Objective existence, and within this understanding of things, seeing things as like illusion, then you should be able to actually establish, demonstrate that there is conventionality of things as well as, and therefore we have this distinction within the conventional reality from the perspective of the worldly convention. We can use the appellations of the two types of convention, the perfect and the false conceptions, conventional realities. And then some scholars say that the Gelugpas say that there is the valid existence of conventional things. And which is some scholars say that because of this, they are followers of Xiantong. And then they establish their view of Rangdong. And so in the 25,000 verses of Panchaparamita, it said that form is not made empty by emptiness, but form is itself empty. And so, in the Heart Sutra, we find mention of form is empty, emptiness is form. What this means is that when you actually look for a form within that object that you are searching for, the form, you will not be able to find that. And therefore, form, since it cannot be found, when you critically look for it, it shows that it has no intrinsic existence. Therefore, form is empty. And so it shows that form is dependent on other many other factors for its existence. And therefore, and it also goes on to say that emptiness is form. Form is not other than emptiness, and emptiness is not other than form in the Heart Sutra. And so in this, there is different ways of, there are different ways of interpreting this fourfold emptiness. Whether something exists or not is delineated on the basis of whether that object which appears to the mind is actually established by or perceived and by a valid cognition or not. If something is the object of valid cognition, then it exists. If something is not the object of valid cognition, then it is not existent. And therefore, when we need to, of course, establish or the existence of things in this way, and then whether things do conventionally exist or not also is established by saying that within the absorption, the perspective of the absorption of the mind, which is totally absorbed in emptiness, directly absorbed in emptiness, of course there is no conventionalities appearing to it, but then the appearance of conventionalities is there when the person comes out of meditation. So Jangyur Rebbe Dorje has said that although things do exist, but then it's not the way it appears to us, as if there is some kind of a solid objective existence which appears to our mind. So in establishing emptiness or selflessness of a person, and here the reason which is called the lack of one and many is used, which has the four essential points. The first one is discerning the or identifying the object of negation, and then the second essential point is the ascertaining that there is the person is not independently one, and then the third is not independently separate or different, and then and then it's coming to the conclusion that the person has no independent existence. And so when you check within yourself whether you exist one with the body and mind, I mean you will not find that you exist either one with the body and the mind nor separate from the body and the mind. And then through this kind of reasoning, saying this, I does not have any inherent existence because it is not neither one nor different or separate from the body and the mind. And so, through this kind of reasoning, one should actually establish the selflessness of persons. When you are able to do that, then you will be able to understand the selflessness of phenomena well. And so, Aryadeva says that Once you have realized emptiness on one object, then you have, through a certain reasoning, then that same reason, when you actually use it in relation to others, you should be able to draw the same conclusion that the things do not have any an objective independent existence. And therefore, he says, what is seen in one is seen in all. So we are into the intermediate verses. So because of this grasping at true existence, we have caused ourselves much suffering. And this illusory horse, clinging to it as of I, this clinging to it, this I, which is an illusion, like the illusory horse, we have helplessly traversed in this samsara and experienced the pains and pleasures. And so how foolish it is not to see this one's own faults such as these. And let's go to the southern lineage, Lamrim. We are on page 236. the Roman number 6, regarding the perfection of wisdom. Marve. Dikasan Sasa. Oh, that's Shaggy. Rambuchipe. So the sixth.
The southern lineage Lamrim, we are on page number 237. On page number 237, the first how to develop space-like absorption has two paths: establishing the selflessness of persons, establishing the selflessness of other phenomena. And while the mere negation of not finding the reality of phenomena is not the understanding of emptiness. So in order to generate a true conviction of emptiness, we need to have a mind which is able to differentiate between the appearance and reality. And as the person is constituted by different aggregates, and it indicates that there is no reality or there is not a person that we can find from its aggregates. As Lama Tsongkhapa stated in the essence of the, all the teachings, as the chariot or any phenomena is being established due to its parts, and for a whole thing to compose, it needs the assemble of all the its different parts. So similarly, in order to understand the empty nature of a person, we have to understand the person as being, even though the aggregates are from the person, but the person cannot be found among the aggregates. The page number 237, we are at the final para. As the jewel Galen says, persons are neither earth nor water. They are not fire, air, and space, nor are they consciousness. Are they then a combination of them? No, they are not, for it says they are not any of these. Do persons distinct from this exist? No, no such person exists, for it says, where is there a person distinct from this? In that case, how do persons exist? Page number 238, so I'm reading the new and revised edition of the Pearl Garland. How to practice the selflessness of other phenomena. Once you have in this way eradicated the conceived object of the thought, I am, you examine the nature of the subject, the innate perception itself. It is said, if you were to see that it existed, it would have no color or shape. It would be unaffected by white and black, and it would be unchanging. Therefore, your mind would have no color or shape, and would not be affected by the words and sins. And also, the ritual text of the protector Gombo, it speaks about the ultimate bliss and the great bliss. And I also used to quote from the Jonang's text, from the Taranada's text. And the external phenomena appear as mere illusions. So even though they appear as existing from their own side, but then how can they appear as illusion to one's mind? And the mind to which all the phenomena appear as illusions, and the mind within us which looks at all the phenomena as inherent existent. So even if we analyze further the mind, the nature of that mind itself, whether the continuum of the mind itself does exist or not, differentiating the different moments of that mind, then due to this reasoning, we are unable to find the mind itself. So therefore, at the conclusion, we will come to the point that all this reality and the nature are not able to mention or not able to express their reality. So therefore, when we have such a conviction or understanding regarding the nature of the phenomena, and this is called the ultimate bliss. And it is also stated that the great yogi will be rested by understanding the emptiness. And all this, as we consider the samsaric world to be filled with this conceptual mind and conceptual thoughts, so being cleared of all these conceptual thoughts and the mind, the great yogi practitioner feels very eased or relieved. Continuing on page number 238, how to practice the selflessness of other phenomena. Once you have in this way eradicated the conceived object of the thought, I am, you examine the nature of the subject, the innate perception itself. It is said, if you were to say that it existed, it would have no color or shape. It would be unaffected by the white and black and would be unchanging. Therefore, your mind would have no color or shape and would not be affected by virtue and sin, white and black phenomena. So we will post the Southern Lineage Lamrim here, and we will continue on the sweep path. Where the second outline, how to train in the spiritual insight, and it can be categorized into two broad outlines of how to practice during the meditative session and in between the meditative sessions. And the first is three, the preparatory ritual or the practice and the actual session and how to do at the end. For the preparatory practice, as stated before, the main, the primary practice should be contemplating or generating the mind of calm abidance. The generation of such a mind has to be done by relying upon a spiritual master who is expert in all this field, and by listening to his instructions, and praying to one's spiritual master, who is not different from one's ultimate deity, and praying from the whole heart that may all my negative karmas be eliminated or cleared. And for the actual session, meditating about the establishment of the selflessness pertaining to person, and meditating on selflessness of phenomena. The first one, as for the first one, in the different sutras and the texts, the selflessness of person has been established due to different reasonings. And for the beginners, the four main reasons to establish the selflessness of person. And the way to think about it is that once we are in deep sleep, so even during the deep sleep, sometimes we tend to feel that there is a kind of the self, the feeling of self within us without much need of making effort, so which is called the inborn grasping of self or inborn self-centered feeling. And the second one is when someone criticizes you against doing something which you have not done, and at that time when you falsify the criticism or when you object to it in terms of that you have not committed such sin, so such self-center or such the feeling of self is not the inborn one, but which arises through certain causes. So having these two kind of substantive feelings, then the person to be, when we speak about the selflessness of person, the first due to the different Buddhist philosophical tenets, as the person is said to be composed of five different aggregates, and we need to the coming text emphasize upon the self being not any of those aggregates, and also not being the collection of those aggregates. And if the self and the aggregates are one, then there will be a lot of critics pertaining to it, which negates the self as being one with the aggregate. One of the reasonings to establish the selflessness of person is through the reasoning of negating whether it is being one or different, one or many, or singular or plural in terms of the aggregates. And Chandrakriti has stated in the supplement to Middle Way philosophy that if the person is one with its aggregates, then as we see different varieties of aggregates, then the person has to be also many, which is not the case. And it is also stated by Nagarjuna in the Fundamental of the Wisdom that is, if the person or if the self is one with the aggregate, and as we pass away from one's life, and as our form or the physical body is disintegrated, similarly, the self will have to be also disintegrated, which is not the actual case. And when we analyze the reality of phenomena, so in order to find something from objectively from the side of object, some even the lower philosophical tenets such as the Chittamatrins points at the self as a consciousness, which is the basis of all. So the main reason behind pointing to the self, the illustration of the self as the point of reference of the self as of consciousness, which is considered as the basis of all, is due to the fact that they wanted to perceive or they assert the self as existing from its own side. So in this way, the selflessness of person is established due to four different reasons. And as the first reason goes, similarly, the second, third, and the fourth one being that self is also not different from the aggregates. And even though the self, if the self is inherently different from its compositional factors, the five aggregates, then due to the aggregates experiencing pain or pleasure, there won't be possible for the self to feel the same. So having analyzed by the above four reasonings, the ultimate nature of the self, so gradually the self-centered feeling within us or perceiving the self as existing substantially has to be eliminated. And such conviction has to be combined by the absence of laxity, the mind of laxity and excitement. And we have to sustain such kind of mind for long duration. And if the such conviction decreases, it may happen during the beginner's time, but then we have to continue to make that mind progress. And as Shurab Senge does the first, he gave the identification of the selflessness of person, and then thinking about the faulty nature of the grasping of the self, self-sustaining. And this order of presenting the selflessness of the person first, and after that, the faulty nature of the graspings, and after that, the selflessness pertaining to a phenomena is wonderful. Otherwise, we may get mistake. We may be mistaken while practicing the order of these two selflessnesses. And as one progresses further, concentrating about the selflessness of the person, as explained in the above manner, our mind gets nearer to the understanding, even the coarse nature of the selflessness, sometimes one develops a great fear within us by feeling that there is nothing existence, and there may be a chances that one may fall on an extreme side of nihilism. So at that time, one have to contemplate that even though the phenomena do not exist as we perceive or we look at them or they appear, but even though from its own emptiness nature of non-existing inherently, but there is existent of that phenomena in conventionally, which is mere imputed, which is mere designated. And this is the way that we have to contemplate during the meditative equipoise state. And even during the post-meditative equipoise, we have to, having generated such a mind of understanding the emptiness, and during the post-meditative state, all the phenomena need to appear as illusory, being the empty nature of all these phenomena. So second is how to establish the selflessness pertaining to a phenomenon. And for that, first we have to establish the selflessness nature of the phenomena which are due to cause and effect. And the second, the uncompounded factors. So basically the two objects, the two categorization of the objects are the compounded factors and uncompounded factors upon which we have to meditate the emptiness of phenomena. And as for the compounded factors, we categorize them further into three, the form, the mind, and the neutral ones. And as for the form, in terms of our human body, which is composed, which comprise as a combination of the flesh and the bones, and we can further analyze whether that human body itself exists inherently or not, as it is also merely a combination of different factors such as flesh and bone. So all the forms and the phenomena are, they do not exist inherently. So, and also the those factors which are composed of those elements will also won't exist. So sometimes when I practice this verse, I reverse the verse and contemplate that since there is not a phenomena or the elements which exist inherently, so therefore all the phenomena, whether it is compounded or uncompounded, since there is not a single point to which we can point and say that it exists inherently. So therefore, if we reverse that order, so sometimes when we speak that all phenomena are merely imputed or designated or nominal, then we may feel that even the title exists, but then when Nagarjuna stated that even the mere title itself doesn't exist inherently, so then the only fact which seems to exist, the title, when Nagarjuna says that even the title or the name itself doesn't exist, then we feel like there is nothing to be perceived inherently. And the second way to think about the absence of inherent nature of the phenomena is in terms of thinking about one's mental factors. The mental continuum that we have, if we break into different parts, one for the morning, one for the session and afternoon, then the mental continuum of a person in general is difficult to find, as that continuum is composed of all these different sessions or the paths of the mental continuum. And if we take the example of one whole year, so a one year is composed of 12 months, and 12 months in turn are also composed by different each days, 30 days, and the days in terms to hours, so on. So we cannot find inherent nature. And Gundam Rinpoche stated in his praise to Nagarjuna that as all the phenomena need to be established due to the assembly of different cause and effect, therefore it is a clear sign that there is not an inherent existence. So, having generated such a mind, so the special insight that we refer to here is a mind that understands emptiness, having contemplated about the inherent, the absence of inherent nature of all the phenomena, is the special insight that we discuss here. We will move to the sacred words of Manjushri. We have completed the first outline that's practiced in the six perfections in order to ripen one's own mental continuum. The second one is practice in the gathering of the four objects, four means of gathering, in order to ripen the other's mental continuum. And as one practice in the perfections, six perfections, especially from generosity onwards, it is very important that we become friendly with the other sentient beings. And one of the means to become near to the sentient being is through four ways of gathering. And the first is to giving them whatever they need through the generosity. And the second way is using very sweet voices and the words to describe them or to discuss with them so that they feel attracted towards us, or they feel subdued and they become ripened to further deliver the teachings. And the third one is in order to maintain one's own life or discipline in accordance with one's own disciples. And the fourth one is also maintaining the same practices, which is in accordance to the other people. So even it will be perfect if you could practice even superior than the other, but even though that is not possible, we have to practice in terms in accordance or in similar to your disciples or the other people, so that we will become more near to the other sentient beings. And what the stages of practicing after that is through dedication. And taking refuge in the three jewels, it may not be limited to the small and the intermediate persons. Of course, there is not necessary that it need not be combined with the bodhicitta. But it is stated here that the refuge taking practice should be primarily done by the two lower persons of the smaller and the intermediate persons. And after that, recitation of Guru's yoga and then engaging in purification. And during the actual session, practicing in the practices of the bodhisattvas and sustaining one's meditative stabilization through the focus of meditating about the objects of the calm abidance and spiritual insight. Next is the concluding verses. So I think I will also read, so we will complete this text. So having practiced in the six perfections, then gradually due to the accumulations of merits and accumulations of primordial wisdom, we will be able to ripen our own mental continuum and we will get nearer to the state of Buddhahood. And through the four ways of gathering, we will be able to ripen other people's mental continuum and make them also nearer or bring them nearer to the state of enlightenment. And the person, and the three kinds of the person who presents the paths in terms of their practice are our teachers, and the essence of those teachings are presented here in a summarized manner. So we are almost completed here. So these are the concluding verses. So due to our desire and attachment, we are born in the samsaric world. And with an aspiration to be liberated from samsara, and we have at this moment, we have obtained the supreme human rebirth, endowed with the leisures and advantages. And the following verses are praying to the Maitreya, then to Manjushri, and also to the two trailblazers of Nagarjuna and Asanga. And next, supplicating Adisha, who is the father of the Lamrim teachings. And having the lineage of, due to the different lineages that we find for the Lamrims, and also by the kindness of all the great spiritual masters, and I have drank the nectar which drops from the words of our great spiritual masters. And Gondar Rinpoche is a real scholar and expert. And he stated that the real precious, which is similar to the precious stone in terms of illustration, the teachings of Lama Tsongkhapa, it will be degenerated due to the wrong practice by the members of the Sangha. And also the great learning centers like here, we cannot merely be proud of just having a large number of the community of the Sanghas. So that alone will not be able to sustain the teachings of Lord Buddha for a long time. And the medicine to whom or medicine to some person may be a poison towards some other. As it is stated in the Tengu, the translation of Lord Buddha's discourses. The medicine to the intelligent practitioners, so the path being shown to them, which are being presented certainly and immediately. So the same kind of the instructions may not be a medicine, or in terms it could hurt or become poison to the other practitioners who need to be practiced orderly or in a sequential manner. So similarly, the path which are being instructed to the persons who need to practice in order or in a sequence and may not be suitable to be given to the more intelligent person who need to practice the paths collectively or in one phase. So the sacred words of Manjushri has tried to elucidate the contents of the two lamrims, the lamrim teaching, and even though for those kind of the disciples who cannot digest the vast and extensive meaning of the great treatise on the path to enlightenment may be benefited in some way by the summarized presentation of the essence of the lamrim by this text. And this is for the Gelugpa practitioners that having a yellow hat and grasping or being attached to saying that this is the teachings of Lama Tsongkhapa, and without really concentrating or studying the great text, and out of distractions, if one let the teachings of Lama Tsongkhapa by being taken away by some robbers, then we are the practitioners whose hands are actually empty. And the fifth Dalai Lama himself also stated here that he was not an omniscient, or he is not someone who understands everything from the beginning. And I have also, due to my own practice and studied, have written or composed this text. And by the explanations given in this text, may I be able to, may all the effort that I met here, may it be a cause to bring all the sentient beings closer to the practice of six perfections.
Mm-hmm.
And I have also seen some Lamrim transmissions, even though they may be very rushed and very deep in terms of the presentations, but they are not applicable to certain sentient beings in terms of their practice. And some Lamrim teachings, Lamrim texts are very extensive during the first part, but when it comes to the later parts and the special insight, they are very short. So taking into account of all these different commentaries and I have written these texts. And I was requested to write this by the great learned Jambar Rinchen, and he has requested for 1.5 months that it is necessary that such a commentary is written, taking into account all the above factors. So even though I do not have very profound lineage and understanding in terms of these Lamrim teachings, and also even without having practice, even though we may quote very extensively from the different texts, it may not be of much benefit to the practitioners. And also presenting or giving teaching to the disciples, even oneself not having the right lineage or initiations, is not so benefit. And during such a degenerated time, I have strived to write a commentary on Lamrim, which eliminates, which we try to present all these details are necessary for a practitioner. Taking into account all these factors and the requests, I've written this text on the 7th month according to Chinese calendar. And the place where I finally completed the composition of this text is the Drepung Monastery, and it was written and it was handwritten by Dongmeba Chile Jiazu. So here completes the sacred words of Manjushri. So I have given the commentary, the transmission of this text of Manjushri with a brief explanation. So the next is the Southern Lineage Lamrim. We are in page number 239. After the Bodhisattva has trained in the six perfections, ripening his mind stream, the way to ripen others mind stream by relying on the four methods of gathering. The ornament of Mayana Sutra reads, for generosity it is the same, explaining them, causing them to be practiced, and personally applying them, are what pleasant speech, implementation of the aims, and consistency with the aims mean. Ripening others' mindstream by relying on the four methods of gathering consists in gathering a following by giving material gifts, protection and dharma according to each disciple's nature. To those thus gathered, you should speak pleasantly according to social norms, asking after their health and so on with a cheerful and smiling countenance and explain the benefits of whatever dharma they aspire to, expressing yourself agreeably so as to guide them along the excellent path. You teach the dharma, especially to those of lesser intellect, those who have committed various sins, those involved exclusively in this life's concerns, careless ordinary people, and so on. Implementation of the aims consists, for example, in explaining that a long life free of illness requires such and such virtues, in ensuring that virtue gradually arises in them, starting with the smallest, in guiding them finally to the state beyond suffering. Page number 240. I'm reading the new and revised edition. Furthermore, since encouraging others to practice without practicing yourself might cause others to comment, for us to tame our minds, first you must tame yours. You should practice even more than they do, or at a strict minimum to the same degree. This constitutes consistency with the aims. The concluding phase, the most important, is to practice earnestly according to summarize how is one to proceed when taking refuge and generating the spirit of enlightenment. You should reflect on suffering according to the lesser and intermediate being's path. Next, in association with Guru Yoga, make a special point of confessing your sins and accumulating merit. Subsequently, the main practice will be able to make the following objects of meditation arise in your mind and sustain them. So the colophon, even though I may not have the transmission, but there is a custom to read it, so I will also read it today. On page number 244, this profound and exceptional instruction of the practical commentary of the stages of the path to enlightenment is the oral tradition of the great master and lord of siddhas. The excellent and glorious Sangawang Lobsang Dembadargi, when teaching it accordingly to a few disciples, they expressed the needs of the transcribe. So I, through concerns, Yendun Jaming transcribed it, putting aside and concealing details regarding the topics of the spirit of enlightenment and of serenity and insight, since they must be learned directly from a master. Your body radiates a thousand lights of the marvelous signs and marks. Your speech voices the melodious notes of the three vehicles' discourses. Your mind apprehends all phenomena as there without confusion. Supreme Guide, Friend of the Sun, I bow to you. The 100,000 streams of all your words substance converge and swirl into a great ocean of instructions. Manjugosha's oral instructions, once well churned, its very essence is collected in the sky jewel known as the Southern Lineage. In the broad expanse of immortality, the pristine intent made of various precious substances, the multiple causes and conditions, is the palace of virtue. This perfectly clear print, a marvel created by the artistry of the skillful Vishukarma. Page number 242, the final para. He who clarifies the teaching of the protector Manjugosha, the master and protector of the will, the great Vajradhara of Dubkang, the glorious, excellent, and venerable Lobsangawang Tenzin Gyatso, in the female water house of the fitting cycle. So here completes the Southern Lineage, Lamrim.
Lamrim.
where the swift path, as Lama Tsongkhapa has stated in the great treatise on the path of enlightenment at the end of the text, and similarly here in the easy path also, Venture Rinpoche summarized the general presentation of all the paths. And the lower path has to be a kind of a step in order to move further and move higher to the higher paths and the practices. And as one listens to the higher paths and the teachings, one needs to generate an aspiration to practice the lower paths more. And while practicing or meditating on these paths, it is important that we have to have an equal mind, a concentrated, a neutral mind, and also it's very important that one need to generate respect to one's spiritual masters and strive to present the teachings in such a way that the teaching becomes the root of all the practices, and in such a way also generate inspiration and encouragement within us that we also, just apart from reading, we also engage in the practice. And if one generates more attachment towards this life, then think about the impermanence nature of this life and how in the next life we may be reborn in the lower rebirths. And think about the sufferings and the faulty nature of this life and the coming next and subsequent lives. And if one is not able to abide by one's commitments and the precepts, think about the consequences according to the karmic presentation of the karmic and results. And if one is not so renounced towards the samsaric events and not able to generate a mind for liberation, then think about the negative signs of remaining in samsara. So ultimately, think that whatever we do, it becomes in some way benefit to the sentient beings. And as we say, the root to the foundation of generating the bodhicitta mind is generating the aspirational mind. And taking the bodhisattva vows and having practiced in the paths of the bodhisattva, one will be able to cut the root of all the afflicted emotions, including the mind perceiving all the phenomena as truly established. So in order to realize such a thing, it is important to have to develop the mind of calm abidance. And in order to develop calm abidance, we need to be able to eliminate the laxity, the mind of laxity and excitement. So here is the concluding verses. So having practiced in the common path, so even though one may have the joyous effort that makes one to walk for eons and thousands of years for the benefit of sentient beings, but it is important that we contemplate on the suffering nature of these different realms. And in order to benefit all these sentient beings, we need to understand their needs and mental states. So in order to understand fully all these details, we need to attain enlightenment, the omniscient mind. So in order to attain enlightenment, we have to strive in order to make even a single moment very auspicious and very practical. So in this way, contemplate on making one's human rebirth, which is endowed with luxurious and advantageous, meaningful. The concluding verses, the sweet part is the contents of all the essence of the teachings presented in the Lamrim teachings. And it was requested by many of the great learned persons, and also in order to revive one's own, my own practice and study it. And maybe I may not be able to present perfectly, or I may have presented wrongly, and even the combination of the words and the sentences may not be in the right way. And there will be, we may see inconsistency between the sentences, or the meanings may not be presented very clearly. So whatever the mistakes I may have made in the composition of this text, I take, may I be forgived by the blessing of all the masters and the deities, and by striving to the writing of this text, by all the merits accumulated by this great act, may I be able to attain the ultimate path. And may the teaching of the Buddha, in particular Lama Tsongkhapa's teaching, to all the different directions. And by that, may all the sentient beings be always remain happy. And may all the sentient beings be never led by the wrong teachers. And may they always be led by the great 12 blessers, such as Nagarjuna. And may they all attain the ultimate enlightenment as soon as possible. So here completes the teaching of swift path. So as for the essence of nectar, I got the transmission from Tejan Rinpoche. So the translation text that we have here is, if you happen to have the poster of Lama Tsongkhapa in the front, the cover is red in color, translated by Jishi Lobsang Tharchin with Benjamin and Devereux Altman, published by Library of Tibetan Works and Archives. So there is a little time, we will try to go as much as possible. Preliminary practices, the essence of nectar, the supreme dharma, the way to practice profound instructions on the stages of Bodhi path, as set forth in verse, is herein contained. I make obeisance and go for refuge to the illustrious, peerless spiritual masters, my root gurus, together with the lineage gurus, each being the combination of all the victories once of the three times. May I be cared for by them without interruption in this and all my successive lives. Herein, by means of verse, I will briefly explain the way for fortunate disciples to practice the profound instruction on the stages of the Bodhi path. The stage of going for refuge. Before me, amid an ocean-like cloud of marvelous offerings, atop a majestic jeweled throne supported by its lions, on disks of lotus, the sun and the full moon, the conquering lord of sages, indistinguishable from my root guru and master teacher, sits radiantly in the center of a network of light rays. With grandeur like the summit of golden Mount Meru, he wears three robes of a monk and glows with a magnificent mask of perfection. His right hand presses the earth, left hand plays in the gesture of meditation, holds an alms bowl filled with nectar. His form is an embodiment of majestic splendor upon which I can never gaze enough. Page number 2. On elegant tables to the right and left of each individual are arranged the volumes of authoritative teachings which have come from each one. The syllables emit their own melody sounds of Dharma. From the bodily parts of every object of refuge, luminous beams written in 10 directions, and from the end of each of these reeds, countless emanations go forth and ripen sentient beings. Looking upon me with compassion, my root guru says, "Fortunate son, if you wish for liberation from the suffering of cyclic existence, I shall guide you." His smiling countenance comforts and delights me. Surrounding me are all sentient beings, including my parents, deliveries with suffering of the six types of beings. Looking here and there, searching for refuge, they weep and cry out pathetically. Alas, from beginningless time until now, I have wandered throughout the six realms. Page number 3. There is no protection or refuge other than the three jewels, which can liberate me and every being from the vast ocean of limitless cyclic existence. Therefore, I and all sentient beings, equal in space for however long it takes until our attainment of Bodhi, go for refuge to the direct and lineage gurus, go for refuge to the master teachers and the Buddhas, Dharma teaching and the realizations. Go for refuge to the exalted assembly, the Sangha. Next is the generation of the Bodhi mind. I am bound in the prison of cyclic existence by the chains of my deeds and mental afflictions. Just as I am tormented, so are all miserable sentient beings who again and again have been my mother and nurture me with kindness. The responsibility to liberate these beings have fallen on me, but at a time like this, when there is little or no way of knowing where I myself shall go, I have no hope of liberating others. Even attainment of the two types of hardship is not completely beneficial for me and is only partially beneficial for others. Therefore, in order to be of ultimate benefit to myself and others, I must definitely achieve the state of victorious ones. Page number 4. If I attain this supreme state, my own encumbrance will come to an end and all virtuous qualities without exception will be achieved. And next is the meditating on four immeasurables. So, even though all sentient beings have been born countless times as each other's parents, without knowing this, they have accumulated bad deeds through attachment and hatred. Thus, they experience only suffering. How wonderful it will be if separated from this attachment and hatred, they would now abide in a state of equanimity. May they abide, I must bring this about, please bestow inspiring strength so that I may be able to do this. Or even though all sentient beings wish only for continuous happiness, not knowing that the cause of happiness is virtue, or even when knowing this, being unable to practice virtue, they lack happiness. How wonderful it would be if they were now to possess happiness and the cause of happiness. May they possess. I must bring this about, please bestow inspiring strength so that I may be able to do this. Page number 5. Or even though all sentient beings never wish for any suffering because of their extreme ignorance which reverses what should be adopted and what should be renounced, they always participate in erroneous and non-virtuous deeds, thus they are tormented by suffering. How wonderful it would be if they were now separated from suffering and the cause of suffering. Or after all sentient beings have become separated from the suffering and causes of cyclic existence and particularly of unfortunate rebirths, how wonderful it would be if gradually they could attain the bliss of higher rebirths and definite goodness, never to be separated from supreme, uncontaminated bliss. The special development of the Bodhi mind in order to liberate all beings equal space, I must quickly attain Buddhahood. To this end, I shall practice the profound instruction on the stages of Bodhipada. So for now, we will pause here. So as announced earlier, I think it was announced about the debate. So in the afternoon session, we will conclude the session around 2, and as soon as this text is completed, till 3 p.m. for 1 hour, we will hold a session of debate. So on this stage, so whatever in way or that you will set up. So on the sides, as there are a lot of scholars, so I want everyone to debate in terms of a normal debate class, whatever the topics that you stir. So for 1 hour, we will have a debate session. So we have here about 30,000 people. So We will love to hear a sound of debate, a spiritual debate, filled the whole space, since there will be a very huge voice. So even though some people cannot debate, so they won't, they need, do not need to feel ashamed. And when Lung Bishay was debating at that time, the Gombasa Rinpoche was very good in debate, and he was the one who debated, and Lung Rinpoche was memorizing and can memorize, and is very intelligent and can remember very clearly. And Gombasa, the previous life, he was very fond of also the 13th Dalai Lama. The 13th Dalai Lama was very fond of him also, and also was the practice of high griver. So when he practiced, and the Lung Rinpoche answered immediately, yes, no, and also. So Rinpoche was not able to remember the letter, so he has to keep silent for a while. And the people laugh, and he was not able to continue his debate. So when we have such big debate, and when only one individual debate, so it's difficult. So here maybe in the front, you can, one person can debate, but on the other side, everyone can debate and make the whole stages and the places filled with the sound of debate. And there are many people came especially from foreign countries. So how we are studying the five texts, so it is important that everyone knows about it. And we will debate today in such a way that as we debate normally by extensive learning, then the next is debate. So the extensive learning through the oral transmission, and next is the debate. So this is important.